This podcast is brought to you by the Village of Bedford Park, your home for business. Over 450 businesses strong and growing with a safe, reliable Lake Michigan water supply. Visit VOBPbiz.com and bring your business home to the Village of Bedford Park.
Now, the WBBM Noon Business Hour.
It's 12:03 on Thursday afternoon, July 31st. Good afternoon. Thanks for joining us. I'm Rob Hart. Pokemon cards are generating serious money across resale platforms. We'll cover that in our next segment. But first, on the economic front, inflation ticks higher, consumer caution lingers, and dissent within the Fed signals growing tension over President Trump's economic agenda. Joining us on the Village of Bedford Park business line, reminding you to bring your business home is Bob Bruska, Chief Economist, Fact and Opinion Economics, based in New York. Bob, thank you for joining us today. And first off, let's talk about the latest reading in the PCE index. That's the Fed's preferred inflation gauge, showing that inflation ticking up once again. And your analysis, Bob.
Yeah, well, inflation is creeping up. It hasn't been falling. The Fed was cutting rates. They were planning to cut rates until yesterday. Very peculiar meeting from the Fed where Fed Chair Powell stopped talking about rate cuts, stopped talking about the Fed's previous plan to have two cuts before the end of the year, and started talking about being more data dependent, and was very neutral about what the Fed would do at the next meeting, and saying that there are going to be a number of data points, and the Fed would be deciding what to do. And it sounds very much less like the Fed is poised to cut rates, very much more like the Fed doesn't know, even though at that meeting there was this dissent. We've got two governors voting for rates to go down, but that doesn't seem to have influenced sort of the center of gravity at the Fed right now.
And it seems like there is some debate about the extent to which tariffs are driving up prices. It is certainly there, but we don't know quite yet how much is going to be passed along to the consumer and how much is going to be simply eaten by businesses.
Well, it's very complicated because, we had that GDP number yesterday, and there's all kinds of crazy analysis about it. And the first quarter, GDP went negative because imports were so high. And now in the second quarter, imports fell sharply, and that boosted the growth rate. And so now people want to blame the strength in GDP for just declining imports. Well, in the first quarter, we lost GDP because of increasing imports. So we have to be pretty fair about this. The inventory numbers, the import numbers, I mean, have really bounced around, and they've affected the GDP calculation. But through it all, we do have weaker consumer spending in train. And so I'm a little bit concerned about the weak consumer spending. The inflation numbers are not going up very fast, but they're not coming down at all. And so the Fed is clearly in a wait-and-see mode, and I think that's where they should be right now, and I don't think they should be leaning anywhere. And we're going to have to wait and see if the consumer finds his mojo and starts spending again.
And then when we take a look at whether or not tariffs will drive up inflation in a meaningful way going forward, is this a situation where maybe interest rate cuts or interest rate hikes as a blunt instrument isn't necessarily it's not built for this moment?
Right. Well, they're not going to stop it. But if we start to get tariff-linked inflation, raising interest rates can keep them from being what we call knock-on effects. You know, the prices go up, and so wages want to go up, and the prices want to go up. The Fed needs to stop that. They want to make sure it's only a one-time increase in prices. What's happening right now is that firms are pricing their goods based upon all those imports they made in the first quarter that came in before the tariffs went up. So we don't really know what the tariff effect is going to be, and firms are holding off deciding what to do with prices until they know where tariffs are going to settle. So we should start to see that pretty soon. Firms are getting some clarity on that, and they'll decide what they want to do with pricing, and then we'll start to see the prices go up based upon where the tariffs are now. We're not seeing that yet. That's why it's so complicated. It's not like there's a zero tariff effect. It's that it's waiting in the background to decide what to do.
Bob Bruska, Chief Economist, Fact and Opinion Economics in New York. Thank you for joining us today. Coming up, a non-sports category of trading card is generating big buzz in the collectibles market.
The only program dedicated to currency events. You're listening to the WBBM Noon Business Hour.
Move over baseball cards. Pokemon cards are exploding in popularity, driving the collectibles market, and even being cited as a profit driver for eBay. Joining us to discuss the trend is Steve Stephen Fischler, CEO of ComicConnect.com and Metropolis Comics based in New York. Stephen, thank you for joining us today. And the first thing that came to my mind, Stephen, when I found out that Pokemon was putting some wind in the sails at eBay is that everything for eBay, it always goes back to Beanie Babies, because that seems to be way back in the 90s when eBay first rose to prominence. It seems like that was the place where a lot of people were buying and selling rare Beanie Babies. And every decade, there is a new collectible to take the place of Beanie Babies. And now we're at Pokemon cards.
Well, you know what? It's interesting to mention Beanie Babies. Beanie Babies had interesting marketing, but they never really developed it beyond their initial stages. So that's why it sort of, you know, imploded. But the people behind Pokemon maybe have learned a lesson from Beanie Babies, perhaps, and it is a phenomenon that has gone on for an incredibly long time, but for good reason. They have really bridged the gap between the physical and the digital world, the physical card and the digital card. There is a worldwide demand. So it's not just the United States, it's not just Asia, it's not just Europe, but it's a combination of all the worldwide markets sort of pooling together to create the current demand that obviously is driving this particular property forward. And they've done really smart things in terms of the marketing of Pokemon rarities. It's not a worldwide phenomenon by happenstance. There's been a lot of thought by a lot of very smart people to really give this property, Pokemon, legs. And nobody knows where it's going to end up, but it is shocking that it is as popular as it was 10 years ago or 15 years ago.
Now, is this also a situation in which kids who grew up collecting Pokemon cards 20 years ago are now adults and they have money to spend and they are jumping into the collectibles market to kind of recapture some of that childhood feeling?
Oh, absolutely. In every collectibles market, you'll have the kids who have grown up that now have disposable income. It didn't necessarily happen with Pokemon. That sort of fizzled out. I'm sorry, with Beanie Babies, but it is true with Pokemon. You're entirely correct. We're talking about partially the reason it is as strong today is the nostalgia factor.
And then when we talk about, you know, we talk about baseball cards, we talk about sports collectibles, we talk about the international appeal of certain sports versus others. But when we talk about intellectual property collections and intellectual property collectors, in which Pokemon is certainly part of the intellectual property sphere, how does that market compare to sports collectibles? When we talk about, you know, it's Pokemon cards or Star Wars memorabilia or rare comic books, how does that stack up to the how dynamic is that market compared to the sports collectibles market?
Well, you know, it is interesting, but it's shocking. Probably about a year ago, I saw analysis that said cards like card sets and properties like Pokemon were eclipsing things like baseball and basketball, which is an incredible statement just by itself. But I, as I said, it is partially the nature of the people collecting it, but it's also the brain cells behind these the marketing of a Pokemon versus the efforts of marketing, let's say, baseball players in card form. Both are done very well, but I think that the people behind Pokemon really need to get some kudos because they've done a fantastic job of making sure that this property, Pokemon, is in front of the eyeballs of everybody. As I said, it's not just happenstance, but, you know, I think the people in the sports world potentially maybe even a little envious of the success of Pokemon and saying we should have that success. And hopefully, you know, that will stir their creative juices to sort of compete with Pokemon. I think it's a good thing.
Stephen Fischler, CEO of ComicConnect.com and Metropolis Comics in New York. Coming up next is social media influencer. Is it a positive for a resume?
Because money matters. This is the WBBM Noon Business Hour.
A big resume question that was unheard of a decade ago is, should you include social media influencer on your CV? It might open doors or raise eyebrows depending on how it's framed. Joining us to discuss is Jason Wachtel, Managing Partner, J.W. Michaels & Company in Chicago. Jason, thank you for joining us today. And if your resume says social media influencer, can that help you or is it a hindrance?
It could help you and it could be a hindrance. It really depends on what you're an influencer for, what your following is, and what the topic is. And that could either be a huge benefit or it could ruin your career.
Now, in some cases, if you are going into a content strategy department or digital marketing, that probably very much so is in your favor. But like you said, it depends on how you use it. I mean, are you there to demonstrate that you have the skills in those disciplines to succeed, or are you there to say, oh, I'm just a star, you're lucky to have me?
Well, if you're a social influencer and you are sort of highlighting that and you have two followers and what you're putting out there is grammatically incorrect, controversial, and not professionally done, that will absolutely hurt you, not help you. Conversely, if you have a humongous following and you're going into restaurant management and you have a following of rating restaurants and you have a huge following and it's done professionally, it will clearly help you in your career.
What is the marketplace for content creation these days? Because it sounds like everybody wants to do it. They don't know how. And in some respects, they don't want to pay an agency to do it for them. So if you have the skills to understand how to game the algorithm and get people to follow you, it seems like you can write your own check in the marketplace.
Yeah, I mean, listen, most companies have, big companies have somebody who's involved or manages their social media, their social content. And if you're able to produce things that have good followings and a good audience, you're going to have a really good career. But if you are in charge of doing that and you are the following goes down, you're going to be out of a job very quickly.
Now, at the same time, this is not new or exotic. The creator economy has been slowly building over the past 20 years. And how have companies dealt with people who have put not only just a social media influencer on their resume, that may be the most latest iteration, but they put, you know, blogger on their resume 20 years ago? How was that evaluated back then?
Well, I don't think many people 20 years ago paid attention to much of the blogger, and obviously there wasn't social media influencers because it wasn't really a thing that people thought was a big industry. Now it is a big industry, and depending on how you market yourself, depending upon your topic, and depending upon your followers, you really could have a very good career in that area. You just got to be careful that you're not talking about anything controversial, because we have clients at J.W. Michaels who will do a background check with somebody posted something controversial, and they lose the job during the background check.
And this is just going to be a bigger deal going forward as more and more people try their hand at being a social media influencer before they move on to the next thing.
Yes, it is a big thing. And what I would say to you, because we see this at J.W. Michaels a lot, is make sure your content is accurate. Make sure it's not controversial. And if you want to put it on a resume or a career, make sure your followers are high and they're going in the upward trajectory, not the downward trajectory.
Jason Wachtel, Managing Partner, J.W. Michaels & Company in Chicago. Thank you for joining us today. Still ahead, artificial intelligence finds a place down on the farm.
The WBBM Noon Business Hour continues.
Good afternoon, I'm Rob Hart. Markets are mixed. Joining us on the Village of Bedford Park business line, reminding you to bring your business home, is Gary Kaltbaum, President Kaltbaum Capital Management in Orlando. Find him online, GaryK.com. Gary, thank you for joining us today. And before we talk about yesterday's Fed decision and the latest reading on inflation from this morning, let's talk about some big numbers coming out of tech, including some solid earnings reports from tech giants like Microsoft and Meta Platforms. And are they not only driving the markets, but in some ways driving the economy right now?
Well, it's just, I have to tell you, an amazing story to be able to grow in the way they grow. Being so big, it gets tougher as you get bigger. And the ability for the stocks. I remember when the first stock hit $1 trillion, I said, wow, there's no way it can do more than that. And we're now, I think, $4 trillion. So it's just great to see the companies are doing good things, right things, and it's been paying off in droves.
And now we're in a situation in which the Fed says it will not cut interest rates. It will not only that, it seems like the phraseology from Chairman Powell is changing. He's even backed away from telegraphing possible interest rate cuts later this year.
Yeah, look, here's the problem. The president has made him more famous and more important than he has been over the last bunch of months. The fact of the matter is, Jay Powell can be lower here with interest rates. He can be at 4 or 3.75, but not 1% like the president's asking. And if the fact that he's not lowering rates, it's not going to make us go into a depression or a protracted downtrend in the economy. A quarter point, a half point doesn't mean much. So, look, you know I'm his biggest critic, Jay Powell. You know that I think he's the one who caused the inflation, waited too long, called it transitory. I just think the best part about it is he hasn't been that important recently, and now he's front page news again, and I really would rather have that otherwise.
And then the PCE report that came out this morning that showed inflation accelerating in the last month. And it seems like the jury is still out, though, on the degree to which tariffs will impact prices. We just don't know yet.
Yeah, I'm sorry. There's a little too celebrating on these tariffs. I'm still a little bit worried. I was big time worried at Liberation Day on that size, but they paused. They've done a ton of exemptions. But the president puts a tariff on Brazil because Brazil treats the ex-president poorly, not because of trade. Just a lot of weird goings on. And I don't care what anybody tells you. A tariff is a tax on us, not them. And when I see they do a deal with South Korea and it's praised, but we're going to tax us 15%, but not tax, they're not going to tax them 15%. I'm a little bit weirded out, and there's still too many moving parts. In other words, every day we're hearing something different. Every day we're hearing a different number, a different country, a different product. And I wish we just get back to some semblance of order. We don't have to look over our shoulder on the tariffs. But look, God bless the president. He loves them, and I think they're here to stay. To what extent, I don't know. And outcome, your guess is as good as mine.
Gary Kaltbaum, president of Kaltbaum Capital Management in Orlando, the website GaryK.com. Coming up next in Technology Thursday, AI-powered tools are providing much-needed help to the agriculture industry.
This is the WBBM Noon Business Hour.
The agriculture industry has always been at the forefront of innovation and technology, and with the rise of artificial intelligence, we're again seeing the potential to revolutionize farming, promising greater efficiency, higher yields, and increased profitability. Joining us to discuss is Andrew Bush, former Chief Markets Intelligence Officer at the Commodity Futures Trading Commission and economic futurist at AndrewBush.com, based in Charlotte, North Carolina. Andy, thank you for joining us today. And this is a great discussion to have, especially when it comes to the impact of artificial intelligence on farming, because you can trace human evolution to advances in agriculture and the ability to feed the planet and its growing population. You add a new technological innovation to that, and you usher in the next era of humanity. And I'm not being too grandiose when I talk about this and how we can apply AI to farming.
Yeah, I think it's similar to the green revolution that occurred with the fertilizers and pesticides back in the 60s and 70s. Look, to be fair, there's been a lot of disappointment with AI and LLMs when it comes to farming, because precision agriculure has not really, delivered on a lot of the promises. But change is happening rapidly, and that's what's exciting about this space, not only with AI, but also with robotics. And we just released a big research piece on this at AndrewBush.com, and we go through all of the amazing things that are happening right now with AI and robotics. And really, it solves so many problems for farmers. but it's going to take a little while before this thing gets really, really rocking and rolling.
Well, the future of AI and farming, what are some of the AI and robotic applications that could define the future of agriculture?
Yeah, I mean, one of the biggest problems is mounting labor shortages, right? So that's kind of the goal here. You're looking at like AI-driven sensors, drones, imaging for inputs like water, fertilizer, and pesticides, and then also robotics for, I don't know, like picking apples or harvesting corn. I mean, these are all potential, and some of these are already in action. You already have autonomous tractors out in the fields in Iowa. International Harvester's got some stuff. I mean, there's quite a few companies that have those products, but you're beginning to see it's like it cuts across everything in farming, and that's what's exciting.
And the interesting thing, too, is it's not just the actual production and harvesting of crops. We're also talking about supply chain efficiency, applying AI to logistics to reduce spoilage on its way to the store.
Yeah, and of course, reducing fuel usage, right? That's another big thing. And I think that's where, I mean, again, we're the thing I try to remind clients, and when I give talks at board of directors meetings or at conferences, I tell them this: today is the worst AI you're going to use for the rest of your life. It's only going to get better, faster, smarter, and more accurate at what it can do. And especially when it comes to agentic AI, but that's a whole other subject. But as you get into farming, the ROI is really going to continue to go up over time.
And I cannot emphasize this enough, Andy, in terms of talking about evolution in agriculture, that it really does. It keeps us alive, Andy. And this is not hyperbole. If you rolled the clock back in terms of agricultural methods of farming back to 1980 and did things the way farmers did 45 years ago, the world would starve. I mean, that is the degree to which agricultural efficiency sustains the human race.
Right. And we need to get better at it. Right. The products that are coming out of the ground need to get better. We're going to get better seeds. We're going to get better development of that. And just it's hard to remember this, but a lot of people thought there would be global starvation back in the 1970s because we couldn't possibly produce the amount of food that we would need for the growth of the population was going, which, of course, as we know, is ridiculous. And just one more thing, the thing that's also exciting about this, as we see volatile climate or climate change, we're going to get better practices on dealing with either flooding or seeds that can handle the intense heat like we've just been experiencing over the last 2 weeks.
I guess the question is, in terms of agricultural technology revolutions, how revolutionary is AI compared to, well, we have this steam engine now, we don't need the ox to pull the thresher anymore?
Right. I mean, is it the same as electricity? Not yet, right? I mean, that was a major GPT, general purpose technology, that changed everything in an economy. This is a little different animal, but it's still extraordinarily impactful, and it has not become diffuse through every industry. But every industry is trying to figure it out, and especially agriculture, because why? Everybody knows what the price of corn, right? And that's the problem. And so if you're going to compete as a farmer, you've got to use every advantage you possibly can to lower your costs, be more efficient, and produce more at those prices. And so that's really the carrot, shall we say, that's hanging out there for farmers.
Andrew Bush, former Chief Markets Intelligence Officer at the Commodity Futures Trading Commission and economic futurist at andrewbush.com, based in Charlotte, North Carolina. Thank you for joining us today. Come join us tomorrow for Entrepreneur Friday. And still to come, car makers are absorbing the cost of tariffs, at least for now.
Lunch money for all generations. This is the WBBM Noon Business Hour.
Two items on the auto front today. Car makers are eating the costs of tariffs for now. When could that possibly change? On the other side of the coin, companies like Carvana are posting record quarterly sales as those tariffs boost the demand for used cars. We're joined by John McElroy, automotive industry analyst and host of Autoline.tv in Detroit. John, thank you for joining us today. And it seems like the automakers are eating those higher tariffs, but are they just doing that because they can, or are they just really itching to eventually pass that along to the consumer?
I don't know is that they're itching to pass it along, but that's going to happen eventually, Rob, because you're right. For the most part, they're kind of eating it. It depends on the company you're talking about. But, you know, they don't want a sudden price shock going into the market. It's, you know, boil the frog slowly. You're going to see prices going up over time here. But like I said, it depends on the company. So, for example, Audi, which has zero manufacturing in the United States, is going to be under enormous cost pressure. Meanwhile, other companies that do make vehicles in the U.S. are trying to find some ways to mitigate it or offset it and that sort of thing. And so they're asking their dealers to eat a bit of the cost. They're eating a bit of the cost, but make no mistake, prices will go up.
And if you're in the used car market, especially the halfway decent used car market, you're doing especially well right now because that's one way consumers are trying to get around the tariffs, and that's money in the bank for Carvana.
Well, yeah, that's right. You know, you're right. If you're in the business of selling used cars, business is good right now. But that's primarily, I should say two things. Like you say, people are looking at new car prices and they're going, oh, my gosh, this is crazy. I'm going to go buy a used car. But the other thing that's going on is that supplies of used cars, inventory, is really tight right now. And you're going to see pretty high prices in used cars. In fact, if you're looking at a car that just came off lease that's about 3 years old, the average price for a used car 3 years old right now is $32,000. So, you know, that's better than buying new, but the bargains are gone.
Now, what if you're the type of person who likes to drive a car into the ground and that maybe you have a vehicle in your house that's 10 years old? Can you expect a decent trade-in value for that as well?
You know, you might be surprised. It might get a decent price. Again, it all depends on how good a shape that the car is in. But, you know, one thing that we're starting to see are some people are going, oh, my gosh, why don't I just put a few thousand dollars more into my existing car? I'll get new tires, I'll get new brakes, I'll get new shocks, I'll clean the whole thing up, because it's a lot cheaper than buying new or used.
John McElroy, automotive industry analyst and host of Autoline.tv in Detroit. Thank you for joining us today.